Isn't that always the way it is? We deeply mourn the young men, all the brothers and sons and husbands and lovers and fathers and neighbors and best friends who died too young, the waste, the inconsolable grief. And we don't ask if they were perfect. There were so many in the Civil War. Latest scholarship says between 650,000 and 850,000 North and South lost their lives. Among those of fighting age, a quarter, perhaps a third, lost their lives. And it wasn't evenly distributed in the South. With this lower population, the casualty rate was higher. Men from rural areas, like much of the South, also died at a higher rate. And for what? In the South, especially, for what? Whatever the Confederates fought for, by the end of the war, it was lost. We need to talk about what they fought for. It's all right there in a document called Declaration of Immediate Causes Which May Induce and Justify the Secession of South Carolina from the Federal Union, dated December 24, 1860. Like the title, it's a dry, tedious document. They didn't have a Jefferson in the room, no Lincoln, Madison, or Churchill to present their case in soaring, aspirational rhetoric. One thing comes through, though. These secessionists were angry, seething with white rage at the North. There was no mention of taxes or tariffs, but there was a lot about slavery. The primary focus of the Declaration is the perceived violation of the Constitution by the Northern states in not extraditing escaped slaves, as the U.S. Constitution required in Article 4, Section 2. And actively working to abolish slavery, which South Carolina secessionists saw as constitutionally guaranteed and protected. The secessionists argued that the Constitution was a contract, and Northern abolitionist states had violated the contract, leaving the Southern slaveholding states no longer bound by the contract. The document quoted with disdain Lincoln's statement that government cannot endure permanently half slave and half free. So there you have it, the cause of the Civil War. Apologists for the Confederates will tell you it's about liberty. You know, like the liberty of the wolf. As the war got underway, the Confederate President Jefferson Davis needed to win over opinion of other nations, such as France and Great Britain. The Confederacy needed trade relationships and, at the very least, did not need other nations helping the Union against the Confederacy. So Davis, in a diplomatic propaganda initiative, reframed the war. It was about freedom, taxes, tariffs, you know, like the Revolutionary War. Just like it, right? This revisionism has persisted till today, but take a closer look. For the South, this war was about slavery. So finally, in 1865, the Confederate flags are furled, the tents are struck, the drums beat slowly, the fifes play lowly. There are all these dead men, all these empty chairs at the dinner table, never to be filled, and nothing to show for it. Wisely, Robert E. Lee wanted to put the war behind him, move on, let the nation heal. All these dead men, nothing to show for it. The flags were furled, the slave economy was prostrate, but that's not the end of the story. There was Reconstruction. Black people began to vote. They won elections. The state legislature in South Carolina in 1868 had 72 out of 124 African Americans. It was the first majority black state legislature. But Reconstruction formally lasted less than a dozen years until the disputed, thoroughly corrupt election of 1876, sometimes called the Second American Revolution, resulted in a compromise with troops withdrawing from the South. The terrorism and violence that preceded this election far exceed any other election in American history. There were troops surrounding the State House as the governorship was disputed in South Carolina. The struggle continued after that, and every time there was progress, racism has reinvented itself. The history of social justice is a history of tides rolling in and out. So there's this rally at a Confederate monument moving into modern times. There's a guy on with a Heritage Not Hate sign, and on one side of him is a guy with a Nazi flag. On the other side is a guy with a Confederate banner. The guy with the Confederate banner says to his buddy, "Who invited the neo-Nazi to our rally? People will think we're racists." It is shocking, but true. White supremacists have infiltrated the white supremacist movement. So some of the white supremacists think they're not racists. They display the Confederate battle flag, but they say, "Heritage, not hate." They've bought into the whole revisionist history of our country, which says the Civil War was about liberty. Some of these people have been marinated, sauteed, and deep fat fried in the belief that black people are, that when black people are up, white people are down. But not all of the defenders of heritage necessarily believe that. Who knew racism could be so complicated? I don't believe you can talk about race, however, without talking about class. There's not just white privilege. There's privilege based on education. Did your parents read to you when you were growing up? There's privilege that derives from growing up knowing you're going to college. There's privilege from knowing you'll never be homeless because there's just money all around you. Those who end up at the top always justify their ascendancy by describing their position as the natural order of things, going back as far as the divine right of kings. We buy into that natural order even when it is contrary to our own social and economic interests. So I grew up in Greenville, attended Greenville High School back when it was a whites-only school. I lived on Prentice Avenue, a little more than a mile from the school. If I walked to the school, I passed through at least two other school districts. There were the black neighborhoods and the children that there attended Sterling High School. But there was also the Parker District. Children from mill villages attended Parker High. There was not just racial segregation in Greenville, there was economic segregation. People at Greenville High knew they had a good thing going. Greenville used to crank out future governors the way Clausen's Bakery cranked out loaves of bread. What if the working people in the Parker District and the Sterling District had gotten together and united around a cause? What do you think about the term divide and conquer? I'm ambivalent because it implies a conscious conspiracy, but sometimes there is. Look at what happens. In every generation, something happens to roll back social justice. It's like a game of whack-a-mole. Slavery is abolished only to be replaced by black codes, chain gangs, and sharecropping. By the 1890s, all the gains made by Reconstruction had been rolled back, culminating in Plessy versus Ferguson, ruling by the Supreme Court. This ruling legalized racial segregation under the questionable rubric of separate but equal. It took another 58 years for the Supreme Court to rule that separate is not equal, and to outlaw segregation. Now I'm going to take a side trip for a moment and tell you a couple of stories you'll all love, and then come back to talking about the ongoing game of whack-a-mole. One story is about Gil Roland, and the other is about my mother. Some of you may have seen the write-up about Gil this week in the Greenville News. He was a prominent journalist for the daily newspaper, the Greenville Piedmont, which was the afternoon paper. He was a liberal and a man of endless curiosity. I remember several times when I came back to college, he would sit me down at his desk in the Piedmont newsroom and talk to me, and sometimes it turned into an article. But in the late 1940s, he used to have a discussion group in his home on Mountain View near downtown. One day, someone said, "Y'all sound like Unitarians." Gil called the Unitarian Association in Boston and said, "Do you believe in racial integration?" And they said, "Yes," and Gil said, "Okay, we're Unitarians." And that's how this church was born. We still have a discussion group that meets every Sunday morning in the founder's room. And about my mother, in 1954, my mother was a teacher at Hollis Junior High School in the Parker District. After the Brown versus Board of Education ruling, which outlawed segregation in the schools, mother started hearing a lot of racist grumbling. Kids were saying, "I'm not going to go to school with any black people," only they used the N-word. My mother assigned her students to write an essay using the term of the day. "How would I feel if I were a Negro?" This didn't sit well with at least one of the parents. My mother was called to the principal's office, where there was a very angry father. The principal was trying to smooth things over and said, "I'm sure Mrs. Ezell didn't mean it that way." And my mother said, "Oh, I certainly did mean it that way." And she asked the father, "Well, how would you feel if you were a Negro?" The man was sputtering and fuming and said, "Well, I can see I'm not getting anywhere. I'm going to take this to the newspaper." And he did. He took his complaint to Gil Roland. Another famous Unitarian of the 19th century was Theodore Parker. He was quoted often by Martin Luther King. He said, "I do not pretend to understand the moral universe. The arc is a long one. My eye reaches but little ways. I cannot calculate the curve and complete the figure by the experience of sight. I can divine it by conscience. And from what I see, I am sure it bends towards justice." Friends, we live in dangerous times. Our liberty is guaranteed by the Constitution, but it is a contingent guarantee. To harvest its promises, we must plow the furrows of its obligations. Freedom is an inalienable right, but it is still contingent. If we lean too hard on that arc of justice and gaze with glistening eyes at distant constellations in the moral universe, the weight of our indolence will shatter the bending arc. If we keep writing checks at the bank of justice without making deposits, we will find ourselves morally bankrupt. Every day, people bleed and die because of injustice. Children's brains are clouded and their futures stunted by poison in the water. But more than that, children are being poisoned by hatred and neglect, divisiveness and separation. What do we do about this? Log on to Facebook and call people idiots? If, as Theodore Parker said, the arc of the moral universe bends towards justice, we got some splaining to do. He died just months before the outbreak of the American Civil War. After that was Reconstruction, Plessy versus Ferguson, and thousands of lynchings, and two world wars, and the Holocaust, and several other genocides, and I could just go on, but I'm going to stop about 2015, so I'll have time for stuff else. Leaders as different as Mao and Churchill declared in moments of crisis that victory was not inevitable. This stands in contrast to Obama's insistence that the defeat of ISIS is inevitable. It's not. This statement of faith by him strikes me as inviting the lovers of freedom to lean on our plowshares and gaze with glistening eyes into an imagined perfect future. Belief in the possible but contingent triumph of justice gives us hope and the energy to persist, but belief in the inevitable triumph of justice is an article of faith that is deflating and opens us to a great possibility of justice delayed. What we are engaged in today is a struggle over what we define as the natural order. John C. Calhoun, a Unitarian to whom we reluctantly lay claim, was the chief intellectual apologist for slavery and racism in the 19th century. The founders of the United States rejected the divine right of kings, a discredited natural order, and established a nation based on the inalienable right to self-government and the self-evident truth that all are created equal. Calhoun, unlike his predecessors, did not believe slavery was a necessary evil that would eventually go away. He believed it was a positive good. He claimed that black people were inherently inferior, unable to manage their own lives, and who benefited from enslavement. Calhoun's new natural order was seized upon by whites, rich and poor alike, to justify why enslavement was just and good in a nation that was founded on equality and self-government. When the flag was furled, this belief did not go away. Even though Robert E. Lee said he wanted to move on, there were these empty seats at the dining room table. The inconsolable grief gave new impetus to believe these soldiers couldn't have died in vain. There was a new incentive to hold on to the terrible, misguided beliefs that they died for. So the survivors put up monuments. I've looked at a lot of these monuments, and there's one theme that runs through all of them. Someday, truth will win out, and the world will acknowledge that these men fought and died for justice and liberty. Some people believe that. They think this is their heritage. They think they don't hate anyone. But here's the real truth. You can't erect monuments to a system of racial hierarchy and domination without hate leaching out of it. The defenders of heritage say they don't hate, but if millions of people feel hated, there is hate, regardless of intent. Today, we've got a new natural order. We've declared drugs the enemy. We've declared war on drugs. Under this new natural order, police shoot black men and boys and get off free. Even though white youth are more likely than black youth to use drugs, we mostly lock up black people for these victimless crimes. While they are in prison, and even after they get out of prison, they're not allowed to vote in most states. It's hard for them to get a job or scholarships or other opportunities they should be entitled to. The war on drugs is the biggest and most successful voter suppression measure undertaken since 1965, when the Voting Rights Act was passed. We are still playing whack-a-mole with white supremacy. As always, much of the resources of the state are devoted to preventing uprising and enforcing the existing natural order. This raises the question, if it is a natural order, why do we need so many resources to enforce it? Not long before his death in 2007, Arthur Schlesinger concluded, "We've got too much pluribus and not enough unum." Pluribus means many, and unum means one. He was referring to the slogan, "E pluribus unum." There's so much that divides us, And it all springs from fear. Fear of immigrants, fear of Muslims, fear of sexual minorities, fear of other races, fear of other. Friends, unless we address the fear, heal the fear, and come out of the fear confident and joyful, we will continue to play the endless, nightmarish game of whack-a-mole. There's something unique that we as Unitarian Universalists can do. We can remember and understand the seventh principle of Unitarian Universalism, the interdependent web of existence of which we are all a part. We can join hands and remind each other and remind everyone we come in contact with through word and especially deed, we are all one. We are all part of one big thing. What touches one of us touches all of us. We can strive for less pluribus and more unum.